This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Alita, Battle Angel. Iron City, the official movie prequel by Pat Cadigan. This book is read by Brian Nishi. This one is for Yvonne Navarro, who provided the roadmap. Couldn't have done it without you. And Amanda Hemingway, a.k.a. Jan Siegel. Don't know where to begin to list all the things I couldn't have done without you. And always for the original Chris Fowler, my one true love in all the universe. Prologue. As General William Tecumseh Sherman pointed out in the late 1870s, war is hell. In the hundreds of years that have passed since Sherman and his army burned the city of Atlanta, Georgia, to the ground, many people have expressed their agreement with this statement. What no one has ever pointed out, however, is war is temporary. Some wars have been short, some unbearably long, but all wars, without exception, come to an end. The same is not true of hell. Hell does not finish. Hell is not temporary. Hell is eternal, and it is populated by the lost souls caught in the temporary insanity of war, those left behind with nowhere to go when it was over. Time moves on as it always does, and recollections of war grow increasingly dim until they pass from living memory. Events become stories, which morph and mutate in a generations-long game of Chinese whispers. Winston Churchill noted that history is written by the victors. But without reliable methods to create and preserve a record of events as they happen, history passes away with the people who made it, and is replaced by whatever stories people remember. And when the major portion of daily life is taken up with matters of survival, people don't remember much. Only those with full bellies and a strong sense of security indulge in the luxury of looking backward. For those not so blessed, history is merely what happened before they arrived. In this way, human history on Earth came to an end. Most people had always thought of the end of human history as the end of time itself, when the universe finally ran down, or blew up, or went out like a light, an event that might or might not involve the appearance of a deity who would sit in judgment of humanity. But there was no bang, just a whimper so faint no one heard it. History came to an end for a very simple reason. After the war, no one wrote any. Before the war, there had been a multitude of cultures that shared their advances in science and technology to accomplish extraordinary things. Chief among these were the Sky Cities, 12 shining metropolises that floated above various locations around the world. People had considered them proof that humanity had truly reached a high level of development, even enlightenment. At no other period in human history had there ever been cities that flew. People up there lived with privilege and comfort, and people down below looked up at them with pride and hope. Then the Great War broke out, harsh and violent and deadly, as wars always are. It killed billions of people, laid waste to the world and everything good about it, and sent what mankind thought were their last, best creations crashing to the ground, all that is, save one. Devastated and traumatized, humanity didn't pause in its fight for survival to write history. There had been a war, an enemy had attacked, and people had fought them with everything they had. Lives were lost, property destroyed, hope obliterated. What else was there to know? The survivors at ground level gathered in the shadow of Zalim, the only city still flying, and they cobbled together a semblance of civilization, structures to live in made from scraps of metal and rubble, in a society made from scraps of ideals and order. A hierarchy developed, with those who could thrive and prosper at the top, and everyone else jockeying for the next most desirable position below them. Welcome to Hell. In order for Hell to be truly hellish, however, it needs an audience. Someone to watch and appreciate it, to be enlightened by what transpires, or, at the very least, entertained. But not passively. Pre-war technology had made many of the entertainments of the day interactive. There was no reason that shouldn't continue. It was a small audience. But then, Zalim's population wasn't very large, to save wear and tear on the environment. This also allowed them to enjoy a more comfortable standard of living. There had been a lot of changes in the flying city. Nothing could ever be the same after the war, and most of those changes were philosophical. Once the actual hostilities ceased, Zalim's residents saw the virtue of a more structured society, with stronger leadership. Everyone hoped war would not come again for a very long time, but when it did, having a distinct and strong authority in place would prevent them from becoming hostages to misfortune. In fact, unambiguous leadership was crucial to their survival now. The carefree days of plenty, when there were a dozen sky cities and travelers came and went at will, were gone forever. What hadn't changed, and never would, was Zalim's complete dependence on ground-level support. The ground-level world would gladly, willingly continue to support the last remaining flying city. Zalim symbolized the peak of human accomplishments and showed that, someday, humanity might reach that peak again. Until then, however, there could be no travel between Zalim and the ground. Aeronautics was a lost technology, and besides, it was the best way to maintain stability in both places. Everyone had to agree to this. They had to be united under a single authority. The best single authority to oversee both Zalim and the ground-level society that came to be known as Iron City was someone who could literally oversee them. Zalim's leader took charge, appointing a chosen few to be his representatives on the ground. The leader had lived a very long time, longer than most people knew, and far longer than any of them would have imagined. He was far too old to be excited merely by the prospect of having power over heaven and earth. Power was boring, unless it was gratifying. His long lifespan made him an expert in gratification, and he knew there was none in simply being an overseer. He had to be a watcher in situ, but without having to leave the comfort of the flying city. Thus, Hell became interactive entertainment, and the Watcher's feet never touched the ground. As for history, it was irrelevant. What happened yesterday, or the day before, or last week was important. History was gone. So there was a great war against an enemy. So what? Nobody remembered who fought or why. It was 300 years ago. Get over it, why don't you? Chapter 1. "Okay, Sarita, I want you to relax for a minute," said the pale, thin man to the patient on the treatment table. She was a middle-aged woman with a round, good-natured face, a halo of salt-and-pepper curls, and, below her collarbone, nothing else. Nothing she'd been born with, anyway. She was one of the total replacement cyborgs the pale man regularly treated at the clinic. She'd gone TR early in life. No doubt, someone at the factory had told her it was the best way to get ahead. As if anyone ever really got ahead at the factory. At the moment, he was stretching her arm out on a support that put it perpendicular to her body, with her hand resting on a tray. The body she had swapped for her own had given her some years of reliable service, but probably not as many as she had been led to expect. For the last couple of months, she'd been showing up at the clinic at least once a week, needing this or that part replaced. She wasn't the only cyborg in Iron City suffering the effects of shoddy workmanship. The Pale Man had been helping people like her since the day he had arrived. Back then, the clinic had been a mom-and-pop operation. Now he wasn't even Pop anymore, which made it harder to keep the sad reality of life in Iron City from getting to him, not just day-to-day in the clinic, but in his other late-night job as well.
"Okay, are you comfortable?" he asked. "Good. Now I want you to think about your right hand."
"Which one?" she asked.
Across the room, the kid sitting in one of the refurbished dentist chairs burst out laughing. The man had actually forgotten he was there. He turned and made an impatient shushing motion at the kid, even though he couldn't help chuckling a little himself.
"As far as I know, Sarita, you only have one."
"Well, yeah, but," the woman grimaced, "the first thing I thought of was my old flesh-and-blood hand, not the real one."
"Both hands are real,"
the man told her, trying to sound comforting as well as firm.
"Remember how I told you your mind has a sort of reproduction of your body inside in it? Well, to your mind, your hand is your hand is your hand is your hand. In fact, it's better if you imagine your organic hand. That's what we want your brain to think, that this is the one you were born with."
"But if the nerves are all connected, shouldn't it do that anyway?" the woman asked.
"It would take me quite a while to explain. Even when everything should be working perfectly, we sometimes have to play little tricks on the mind to help it along," the man replied. "I don't think you can take that much time off work."
"Yeah, I suppose not."
The woman's fingers wiggled, then began tapping on the tray. She heard the noise and raised her head. Her fingers kept moving.
"Well, will you look at that?"
The man helped her sit up.
"And that's what it's all about," he said cheerfully. "How does it feel?"
"Natural as anything," she said,
still tapping her fingers on the tray.
"No dropout sensation at all."
Her smile faded slightly.
"I hope it lasts."
"If you have any trouble, just come back."
The pale man hesitated, wanting to tell her that he was working on something, and if it turned out the way he wanted, no cyborg would ever have any delayed motor function between older and newer parts again. It would make her happy, and she deserved something to be happy about, to look forward to. But he didn't know how long it would take him to get the chip working properly. Another 2 weeks, or a month, or 6 months. Or the whole thing might blow up in his face and he'd have to start over from scratch. Meanwhile, she'd be waiting, patiently at first, but eventually she'd get anxious, and so would all the people she told about it. And there he'd be, unable to produce an instant miracle and unable to explain why, at least in layman's terms. So there they'd all be with one more thing to be unhappy about. The cruelest thing he could do to these people was to give them too much hope too soon. If he wanted to be a nice guy, he could give them lollipops. Lollipops were real now, and all his patients loved them. He took one from the jar on his desk and handed it to her.
"If you get caught short," he said, "I can show you a trick with a box and a mirror that..."
"You showed me already, remember?"
the cyborg said, tucking the lollipop in the breast pocket of her overalls.
"It was back when Lefty here," she flexed her hand, "fell apart, and the replacement was late, and it felt like someone was twisting my fingers, even though I didn't have any." It can help with coordination, too, the man said.
Really?
Said the kid in the reclining chair. A mirror in a box? The cyborg gave him a look.
What's it to you, meat boy?
She turned back to the man suddenly, looking apologetic.
No offense, Doc.
The pale man laughed.
None taken, Sarita.
He showed her out and went to call the next patient in. But the row of chairs in the hallway outside the treatment room was empty. The doctor frowned, trying to remember who had been waiting there earlier. Perhaps he should have sent the kid out with a clipboard to take names. It was important to acknowledge people who were waiting. And then again, maybe not, he thought as he heard a thump behind him. The kid had set the chair at an extreme angle without belting himself in, and he'd slipped out onto the floor on his head.
Put it back the way it was, Hugo, the man said, or at least fix it so people won't have to sit upside down.
The kid's face was pink with embarrassment as he readjusted the chair and then moved to the far less elaborate one beside the desk that had once belonged to the man's former partner, who also happened to be his former spouse. The chair had not been easy to come by. His ex had insisted on good lumbar support. When he'd finally found this one for her, she had complained it wasn't good enough. Not that anything ever was. Not compared to what they'd had before they'd come to Iron City. Hugo was now rolling himself back and forth across the width of the office. The wheels rattled. The pale man might have thought it said something significant about Iron City, that a 17-year-old amused himself with the chairs in a cyber surgeon's office rather than doing almost anything else. But he knew Hugo well enough to know the kid wasn't merely bored. Hugo dropped by regularly, and no matter how busy he was, he couldn't bring himself to chase the kid out. Too many people had turned their backs on Hugo already.
"You're not fooling me,"
Hugo said suddenly.
"About what?"
the man said with some alarm.
"I know how you got that mark,"
Hugo said. He touched the spot in the middle of his own forehead.
"It's not from acne or chicken pox, or getting hit with a ball bearing at a motorball game, and it's not a birthmark either."
"Well, congratulations."
The man sat down at his workbench on the far side of the room and removed a sheet covering a partially disassembled shoulder joint attached to an arm. "Since there aren't any other patients right now, I'm going to work on a project for a while, and I'd like a little peace and quiet so I can hear myself think."
"What is it?"
Hugo asked.
"A chip for better performance."
The kid laughed.
"Are there any chips for lousier performance?"
"In this town, too many," the man said, angling a magnifying lamp over the ball joint. "I bet you could get all the peace and quiet you want in Zalem," Hugo said. "They've probably got soundproof rooms and an army of security guards to keep punks like me from bothering you. Why would you ever leave?"
The man turned on a monitor and studied a scrolling display of readouts.
"See? You being from there, that explains a lot,"
Hugo went on after a few moments.
"But, like, there are some pretty smart people in Iron City. I'm no dummy myself. You gotta have some smarts to survive here. But even the smartest people in town don't know what you do. They aren't..."
The kid paused, searching for the right word.
"Educated."
The pale man paused in the act of adjusting some very thin wires just below the shoulder joint to look at the kid from under his eyebrows. Hugo's assessment of his own intellect was correct as far as it went. That is, he was no dummy. But in truth, Hugo had no idea how smart he actually was, which made him too smart for his own good, which might well get him killed.
"We don't get much education in Iron City," the kid was saying. "The only reason they make anyone go to school is so they can work for the factory when they grow up. Worker bees that can read and write and count past 10 without taking their shoes off. They..."
"Hugo, do you ever stop talking?"
the man said, and was instantly sorry when he saw the stricken expression on the kid's face.
"Sorry, I didn't mean to," he hesitated. "I just keep losing my train of thought, and this is really important."
It could make a big difference to how well cyborgs function, especially TRs.
Oh, yeah? Too bad you didn't get there before my old man dropped dead. He might have had another 20 years to perform better in the factory.
He rolled himself across the floor to the workbench.
What's so great about this chip?
It'll improve integration between newer parts and older ones. This will reduce rejection and speed up the healing process. That means less medication. It has other potential. No more dropout, hesitation, or scrambled signals to nerves.
The man felt himself warming to his subject. He was really just thinking out loud.
But thinking out loud felt so much better with another person in the room, even if the other person was a street kid who didn't understand more than 2 words in every 5.
See, what happens sometimes is, in high or extended performance situations, a cyborg will intend some movement, maybe something small with the fingers, or something large, like walking up steps, and suddenly nothing happens. It only lasts a second or half a second, but it's startling, disturbing, especially when you're in the middle of some complex task. And if you're lucky enough to have achieved a state of flow, it's like having the floor pulled out from under you. If I can do something to preserve flow for cyborgs, I'll die happy.
The man frowned.
No, actually, I'll die happy if I can also eliminate hesitation and stutter. That's really just dropout on a much tinier scale. You make a movement, nothing happens, and you make the movement again, which is different from echo, where the same intentional movement repeats 2 or more times. The problem, I mean, the overall problem, is the speed of brain impulses. Even the most advanced cyborg body isn't quite as fast as organic nerves. Almost, but not quite. I've been trying to speed up cyborg bodies, and I don't just mean accelerated movement. However, accelerated movement is mostly what I get.
He was about to go on, but decided to have mercy on the kid just for staying awake. Hugo was silent for a long moment. Then,
see? That's what I'm talking about. There's no place to go in Iron City if you want to learn stuff like that.
I could teach you if you wanted to learn, the man said.
Oh, yeah, right. Can you see me as Doc Hugo? Is that why you came here to teach kids like me how to be doctors? I wouldn't buy that for a second. I can hardly believe you're here fixing up cyborgs. Why didn't you stay in Zalem, where you could have everything you need? Why would you come to a place like this?
The pale man was saved from having to think of a way to dodge the question by the sound of the clinic door opening and closing.
My next patient is here, he said. Do me a favor and bring them through, will you?
Sure thing, Doc, Hugo said. But just as a favor, I don't want a job as your receptionist.
You could do worse, the man said.
Hugo laughed.
I already do a lot better.
Business picked up later in the day, as it always did. By the time the last patient left, the pale man was too tired to see him out. He collapsed in the refurbished dentist's chair Hugo had been playing around with earlier and put his feet up. When Hugo asked him if there was anything else he wanted him to do before he left, the man waved him off.
Okay, Doc, Hugo said. See you tomorrow.
Not if I see you first, the pale man replied silently.
Dr. Daisen Edo, educated cybersurgeon to Iron City's cyborgs, good Samaritan and befriender of street kids too smart for their own good, told himself he had to get serious about hiring some staff. A nurse, at the very least. The income from his other job was enough that he could afford someone good, even if it wasn't enough to send Hugo to med school. No amount of money would be enough for that. The factory chose very few people for further education. The rest, like Hugo, were left to the social Darwinist crucible that was Iron City. Yet Edo still kept hoping that he could awaken something like intellectual curiosity in a street kid who mainly saw him as a customer for various bits of tech, when he wasn't pumping him for information about Zalem.
It was just that Hugo seemed more thoughtful than most of the kids running around Iron City. He had a gang of friends, a crew, that he hung out with, played motorball with, raced gyro bikes with. Occasionally, there was a girlfriend, but none of them held Hugo's interest for long. Hugo had something different on his mind. He talked about Zalim so much that sometimes Ido thought he had a fixation. That was never good. Zalim fever was a phase most young people went through. Young people loved the idea of beating the system to make their way to the last and greatest flying city of them all, the one the enemy could not crash. Youth was all about believing that if you wanted something badly enough, if you were willing to do whatever it took, all that effort, all that motivation would become a magic beanstalk you could climb all the way to Zalim. And once there, all that determination and resolve would earn you a hero's welcome. Most people grew out of Zalim fever sooner or later. Later was more difficult. But Ido could understand the reluctance to let go of the Zalim dream. It must have felt like giving up on the whole idea that there could be something better than plain old everyday life, like turning your back on heaven. Ido couldn't help thinking that Iron City's existence was proof that there was a very big difference between giving up your dreams and waking up to a reality where a force beyond your control had given your dreams up for you. And that wasn't true only in Iron City. It was true in Zalim, too. Most people in Zalim had no idea. They had everything they could possibly want, so there was no need to dream. Unless you weren't perfect. His daughter had been destined to be perfect. Her lineage, like that of everyone else in Zalim, was impeccable. He and Chiren had lived properly, without giving in to weakness or decadence. And as far as he was concerned, his daughter had been perfect, the most beautiful creature in their beautiful floating world. Her illness had not been a flaw. Zalim's geneticists had missed something, failed to correct it. Ido didn't care. Nothing could spoil her perfection for him. The flaw was in Zalim's notion of perfection. Or more precisely, the flaw was in the vision of Nova, the man in charge. The chrome optics he had over his eyes supposedly gave him enhanced perception beyond the spectrum normally visible to humans. But Ido didn't think it was enhanced at all if Nova couldn't see his daughter was perfect. It was Nova who evicted them from Zalim. He sent glorified errand boys to their home to tell him and Chiren they had to leave. A very hard decision, the errand boys said, neat and apologetic in their immaculate errand boy suits. But there was no other way, nothing to be done. Ido and Chiren had produced something so flawed, normal life would be impossible for her. The girl had to be enhanced simply to do what normal people did unassisted. This was not how things were meant to be in Zalim. A flying city had to be inhabited by people better than those at ground level. Otherwise, there was no difference between the two places, and they might as well let the grimy unwashed come up and track dirt all over the place. No one wanted that. Surely Ido and Chiren could see how important it was to preserve Zalim as it was supposed to be, especially since it was the only flying city left. In his mortification and anger, Ido had finally understood why there were no physical defects, no disabilities or atypical mentalities. In fact, no marked differences in perspective among the privileged population of Zalim. And then he was only too glad to leave. But first he demanded that Nova come to their home in person to say all those things to his face, to Chiren's face, to his daughter's face. To see they were not merely names crossed off a list, but living people condemned to exile. Chiren had been utterly devastated. But her heart had not yet frozen over. There had still been enough humanity in her to persuade Ido that having an autocrat tell their daughter she wasn't good enough for a Zalim would be even more destructive. In the end, Nova's refusal to see them was his one and only small mercy. The manner of their leaving was one more humiliation. Heavier-than-air flight was forbidden, punishable by death, a sentence carried out by ground-level robot enforcers called centurions. Mostly, centurions existed to make sure people born on the ground didn't try to get above their station, literally. But neither would it do to have the residents of Zalim lowering themselves, also literally. If they did, the people on the ground would demand to visit Zalim, resulting in a complete breakdown of the social order. For the last 300 years, the world had been stable and at peace. No wars, no internal unrest, no problems. It would be insane to risk doing anything to spoil it. The supply tubes that ran from dispatch centers on the ground up to Zalim receiving stations were only for cargo, food, manufactured goods, and they were set for one direction. Nothing ever came down through a supply tube. Zalim didn't exist to supply anything to the world below. The only way anything went down was via the ragged disposal chute on the underside of Zalim's disk. At one time, the chute had been longer, but it had been too much of a temptation for daredevil ground dwellers and had to be shortened. That was what most people had been told. Any other story had passed from living memory. Only people with the extensive education available on Zalim knew more. Not that it mattered. The long and the short of it was, the chute had always been used for waste disposal, and it was the only way Ido, Chiren, and their daughter could travel to the ground. Nova allowed them to have a pod constructed so they could survive the landing without serious injury. The pod would be good only for that one landing, and would accommodate only themselves and very little else. They were forbidden to take with them anything that could reveal detailed information about Zalim, what the city looked like, how many people lived there, what they had. People on the ground were better off just imagining how much better Zalim was. If they actually knew, they might get so dissatisfied they'd do something foolish. Yes. It was too bad they had to leave the girl's wheelchair behind, but Ido and Chiren could make another for her out of the materials available to them. The place wasn't called Iron City for nothing. There was plenty of salvage to be repurposed. The people there had become very good at finding new uses for Zalim's discards. The landing hadn't been the mild bump the bureaucrats had claimed it would be, but Ido had added a lot of extra padding, especially for their daughter. She came through the landing without physical injury or trauma. The final humiliation was where they had landed. Ido and Chiren had known in advance, but that did nothing to lessen the effect of what they saw when they opened the pod's escape hatch. Zalim had thrown them out with the trash. Had thrown them out as trash. And then, as if to drive the point home in the most obvious way possible, more refuse poured down on top of them, some of it bouncing into the pod through the open hatch. Chiren stared in horror at the fragments of plastic, dented pieces of metal, shredded bits of cloth, wires, and machine parts. A moment later, she tore herself and their daughter out of the safety cushions and rushed out with the girl in her arms, her face wild with panic. Ido followed, intending to tell her she should have waited. If something had fallen on them, they might have been killed. But as he made his way over the absurd and treacherous landscape formed from generations of junk and discards, he spotted a small bowl, scratched but intact. Some impulse made him pick it up. First thing for their new home, he thought. Then suddenly he understood why Chiren had bolted. She had been terrified of seeing something she recognized. He tossed the bowl away. Their daughter had been young enough that Ido had hoped adjusting to their new life wouldn't be too hard. Obviously, they were living in reduced circumstances, but children were always just children. even when they were disabled. They didn't know if they were rich or poor. Occasionally, the girl asked why they were doing without something they'd had in Zalem. She accepted Ito's explanation that there were some things Iron City just didn't have, cheerfully, without complaint. Which was a relief. Chiden complained enough for all of them. Ito did his best to keep his own spirits up for her sake, trying to make himself believe his daughter's condition wasn't getting worse before his eyes. It had taken Chiden throwing a soft, near-rotting tomato at him for him to realize how far they had really fallen. All the best food went up to Zalem. Iron City ate only what the Flying City rejected. The patients at the clinic introduced them to the black market. Ito was shocked at how quickly it became as normal to him as the open-air food market. Even so, they might have ended up having to close the clinic and find squat space under the causeway if they hadn't discovered Motorball. Or maybe Motorball had discovered them. Word had gotten around from their patients that there were a couple of cybersurgeons in town that could work miracles with a little masking tape, copper wire, and spit. The work paid well. Not enough to restore them to anything near their previous standard of living, but they wanted for nothing. Ito began working on a project that might change their daughter's life for the better. Their daughter, Ito was about to speak her name when he opened his eyes. The clinic was dark and silent. He'd fallen asleep in the chair. He should get up, eat something, and then go out. He needed the income that only his nighttime business could provide. Except there was someone banging on the clinic door and ringing the bell over and over and over. That was what had awakened him, Ito realized. Someone had an emergency and they weren't going to go away. He struggled out of the chair, stretched and half-stumbled to the door. It was an emergency, all right, but not the kind he usually took care of.
"What the hell happened to you, Hugo?"
he asked, easing the kid into the wheelchair he kept near the entrance. Hugo made a noise that might have been, "Don't ask," or possibly, "Kicked my ass." Ito didn't pursue it. Chapter 2. Some hours earlier, about the time Dyson Ito was dozing off in his dental chair, Hugo was thinking about breaking a rule that, in his personal code, was supposed to be unbreakable. Prior to that, he'd been thinking about Ito. Nobody worked as hard as the doc, and cyborgs all over Iron City sang his praises. There was no one else with his cyber-medical know-how in Iron City who was willing to treat cyborgs even if they couldn't pay right away, or at all. Well, there was his wife, his ex-wife, rather. When the clinic had first opened, they'd split their time between it and taking care of paladins at the stadium. The Motorball income must have let them keep the clinic open. Hugo had no idea how Ito kept the clinic going since he'd quit Motorball. His wife was still working at the track, but no longer at the clinic, having left Ito. Hugo doubted she was donating anything. There weren't a whole lot of ways to make good money that didn't involve something dangerous and or illegal, and the doc didn't seem like the type for either. Oh, he'd done a little trading on the black market, but everybody did. Obeying the law all the time in Iron City was a good way to starve. The factory made the rules, and the game was rigged. If you wanted to do better than just survive, you had to make your own rules. Sooner or later, this would put you on the wrong side of the law. It was more important to stick to your personal code. Your word had to be your bond. Anyone you dealt with had to know without a doubt there were lines you wouldn't cross, no matter what. Hugo had been scrupulous about not violating his own code. But then, he wasn't much like other guys his age, and he knew it, albeit in an oblique, most unconscious way. Early in his life, circumstance had caused his focus to shift from material things to intangibles, like trust and honesty, will and intention, even inspiration and love. not that he understood himself in those terms. Hugo didn't spend a lot of time contemplating abstractions. For most of the day, he'd been at Ito's clinic, partly to find out what Ito was in the market for, besides servos, that is. Ito always needed more servos, but also to pump him for information about Zalim. Ito seemed to think he was curious about scientific and medical stuff, like he wanted to be a doctor or something. He didn't, and he'd have been shit out of luck if he did. People like that came from the factory. Nobody knew where the factory got them, but Hugo knew it wasn't Zalim. They didn't have the mark. Which raised all those questions about how Ito had ended up on the ground, why he wasn't trying to go back, why Zalim had let him and his wife go in the first place, and so on and so forth, around and around and around. The doc was trying to play it close to the vest, but Hugo felt like he was wearing him down. Ito had started to let things slip now and then. Hugo hoped if he let the doc keep talking about things like his famous chip that would integrate new this with old that, Ito would get talkative enough to confide in him. The doc wanted someone to confide in. He was obviously lonely as hell. He probably would have preferred another doctor like his ex-wife, but he'd settle for someone who'd listen to his scientific blah blah blah. Right now, however, Hugo was wishing he hadn't given in to his hunger pangs, or that he'd gone instead for a pineapple coconut shake he could have tied onto his gyro bike handlebars and sipped as he rode home. But no, he'd felt like falafel, and he'd parked near the coffee shop while he ate it, in a spot that had given him an unobstructed view of the woman sitting alone at one of the sidewalk tables. It was just chance that she was there having an extra-large cappuccino at the same time. It was also just chance she decided to wear a bracelet today. And it was just chance that he saw her wearing it. She was a slightly plump woman with dark brown skin, short corkscrew curls, and large dark eyes, dressed in a t-shirt with a bunch of black cats on it, and jeans faded almost to white. She was anybody. Hugo couldn't have said whether he'd seen her before or not. But the last time he'd seen the bracelet she was wearing, it had been on his mother's arm. It had been a gift from his father, and his mother had worn it constantly, waking and sleeping, until the day she died. Gifts had been few and far between at Hugo's house. His father had done his best, but being a drone on a factory assembly line didn't pay a fortune, and money had to stretch even further when Hugo had suddenly come along. He'd been a surprise to his middle-aged parents, who had thought any diapers in their future would be on their grandchildren. Hugo had never doubted his parents loved him. His father called him an unexpected pleasure, and his big brother was overjoyed to have a little brother to look out for. It was a happy home, and like all kids from happy homes, Hugo hadn't known they were poor. Only later on had he realized that sometimes his parents and even his brother had skipped dinner to make sure he never had to go to bed hungry. His mother had talked about getting a job when Hugo started school, but his father begged her not to. "Then you'll get enhancements, too. One of us has to stay completely human for our boys, querida." His mother told him he was the most human person she knew, no matter how much of his body got replaced, but she honored his wishes. She tried to pick up extra money by taking in laundry or doing housework, but most people gave their business to those who were enhanced with special devices and attachments, rather than someone who only had two natural hands. Once in a while, though, those cyborgs got all booked up, and they'd throw some work her way. The infrequent gifts were most often useful, necessary things, not some extravagant, non-essential like jewelry. Jewelry's only purpose was to use up money better spent on groceries. But one night, Hugo's father had come home and put a small drawstring bag made of dark green velvet on the kitchen table in front of his mother. Hugo and his brother had been jumping up and down, yelling, "Open it! Open it!" while she stared at it like she thought it might bite her. The expression on her face when she saw the bracelet was one Hugo had rarely seen. Big Bro told him later she was like a line in a poem he had read once, surprised by joy. The bracelet was the last thing she'd expected to get, something she hadn't even known she'd wanted until that moment. She held the 2-inch band of hammered copper in her hands and examined it closely. There was a dark green gem set into the middle of the band, the same dark green as the little velvet bag, which Hugo thought was a very cool thing. He asked if it were an emerald, and everyone burst out laughing. Hugo waited for his mother to say his father had to take it back because they couldn't squander money on useless things, but she hadn't. Instead, she put it on and never took it off. Big Bro told her she shouldn't do that, because someone might mug her for it. She should put it away in a safe place. She had refused. Jewelry is meant to be worn, not hidden, she said. Hugo had worried. He hadn't been too young to know Iron City was a dangerous place. But nothing bad ever happened. His mother called it her lucky charm, and Hugo wondered if maybe that little bit of copper, with the pretty piece of glass, really had some kind of power to ward off evil. If so, it hadn't extended to his father. It didn't stop him from replacing more and more of his body until there was hardly any organic flesh and blood left. The first time his father had come home with a cyber limb, Hugo had run away from him crying. His father had been baffled at Hugo's reaction. He'd thought Hugo would find his machine arm fascinating, especially when he saw how it could unfold, extend, and rotate, and how the telescoping fingers could bend in every direction. His mother and brother had told him he'd hurt his father's feelings. Big Bro spent a lot of time trying to talk him around. People lose their arms and legs in accidents, or they get cancer in their bones and have to have something amputated. You really think they shouldn't be allowed to replace them? Hugo hadn't known how to explain that his father hadn't lost his arm. He'd traded it for something that didn't even look human. He did apologize to his father, but from under his bed, where he couldn't see the metal thing attached to his father's body. His father had not taken offense or been angry. He said he'd keep the arm covered up at home to give Hugo time to get used to it. Later on, Hugo overheard him telling his mother and Big Bro that you never knew what might scare a little kid or why. The world looked a lot different at that angle. It wouldn't do any good to say he shouldn't be afraid of something. Instead, they had to show him they still loved him, and not everything that looked scary was something to be afraid of. Hugo had loved his father so much for that. This was the father he knew and loved and trusted. He just didn't understand how that same father could want a machine arm. It wasn't only that it looked scary, it ruined hugs, too. In any case, his father did cover the arm at home, and Hugo tried hard to act like he was okay about it. In truth, the thing was scarier when he couldn't see it. What was it doing when his father put a blanket or a sweater over it? He had nightmares about it detaching itself from his father after everyone was asleep, crawling into his room and trapping Hugo in his bed so it could saw off his arm and replace it with a machine exactly like itself. After a while, the nightmares tapered off, though not as soon as Hugo let everyone believe. He was no longer afraid of the machine sticking out of his father's shoulder, but he didn't like it. The best he could do was tolerate its presence. No one told Hugo when his father had replaced his legs. He wouldn't have known at all, except one morning his father had forgotten to lock the bathroom door. Hugo was too old by then to run away and hide under the bed. The legs were more human-like, but Hugo couldn't help thinking about his nightmare. Now he imagined the machine arm had replaced his father's legs while he slept, although he was too old to believe things like that could really happen. But he was not too old for nightmares.
In the new ones, his father was telling him to get up. They were going to be late for work at the factory. Hugo rolled over to find his father was all metal, with four machine arms and two heads. Then he threw back the covers and saw his own body was also all metal. Sometimes he had eight legs like a spider, other times a single wheel like a gyro. Occasionally his father would start falling apart, and when Hugo tried to get out of bed to help him, he did too. In retrospect, Hugo realized his father had already replaced his legs when he'd given his mother the bracelet. It was around the time he'd noticed his father was walking differently. The factory must have given him a bonus for becoming more of a machine. That was what they had in the factory, after all. Lots of metal machines. Only machines weren't supposed to die. Wasn't that why his father replaced his entire body, so he could go on working at the factory forever with the rest of the machines? When a factory drone keeled over on the job, shouldn't they have just called tech support or maintenance and had them fix whatever was wrong? When a machine malfunctioned, you just replaced the faulty part or whatever, and it went back to work. Factory reps didn't come to the house and tell the machine's family he was dead. His brother had had to barricade him in his room so his mother could talk with the reps without Hugo's calling them liars and trying to punch them. After the reps left, Hugo sat out on the front steps stubbornly waiting for his father to come home so he could tell him about the lying factory scumbags who had come to the house claiming he was dead. Hugo didn't remember much about the weeks after that. Big Bro and his girlfriend Nana got married. Nana spent a lot of time with Hugo and his mother while Big Bro was at work, at the factory, of course, but his job was better than their dad's. Hugo begged him not to swap any parts of his body for machines. His brother had promised he wouldn't and didn't mind when Hugo insisted on checking. 2.5 months later, their mother died in her sleep. When Hugo found her, she'd still been wearing the bracelet. Some good luck charm. It had failed his mother when she'd really needed it. He'd never expected to see it again. Hadn't even thought about it in years. And now, here it was, on the arm of some stranger who had no idea what she was wearing. Hugo finished his falafel, tossed the bunched-up napkin in a nearby trash can, and got ready to start the gyro. Without thinking about what he was doing, he walked the gyro forward, through the no-parking area in front of the cafe, until he was parallel with the woman just as she ordered another cappuccino. He waited until the waitress went inside before he started the engine. Then he reached over, swiped the bracelet off the woman's forearm, and took off. "Sorry, lady," he thought, without looking back. "But frankly, it didn't go with your outfit." Hugo knew no one would chase him. The woman wasn't hurt, and a cheap metal bracelet wasn't worth the effort. But just to be sure, he took a lot of back alleys and side streets, even walking the gyro along a few passages that were too narrow to ride through. Half an hour later, he fetched up on the southeast edge of the trash pile. It wasn't an area he'd spent much time in. Apparently, no one else did either. Normally, that would have been reason enough to head for someplace more populated, where a person was less likely to get mugged. Although that hadn't helped the lady at the cafe, she was out one bracelet. Well, tough stuff. At least she hadn't been roughed up. The bracelet was just some piece of costume jewelry to her. She'd forget all about it as soon as she got another. And maybe if he told himself that enough times, Hugo thought, he'd forget that he'd sworn he'd never steal from all-natural people or those with only a few cyborg parts. Only total replacement cyborgs were fair game. TRs were just talking heads riding around in metal bodies. Jacking TRs was okay. They could take it. All you had to do was give them a few shocks with a paralyzer to take them down, then disconnect the cyber core. After that, you tipped off the factory prefects anonymously,
They'd pick the core up wherever you left it and put it on life support. Meanwhile, you chop the body and shop the parts, unless someone wanted the whole thing, no assembly required. Losing a body was nothing for a TR because they'd already lost their body. They'd traded it for hardware. They could always get another, and with any luck, they wouldn't get jacked again too soon. But so what if they did? It was still all just hardware. It wasn't a real body. Hugo put his feet up on the gyro's handlebars and leaned back a little, turning the copper band over and over in his hands. After his mother died, he'd assumed his brother had given the bracelet to Nana, and she'd just put it away and never worn it. She and Big Bro took him in and became his mother and father, which was sort of weird. But only a little. They were his family, after all, and they were all he had left. He kept waiting for Big Bro and Nana to have kids so he could be like their big brother, but it never happened. He wondered if they were going to do what his parents did, wait till he was all grown up and then have an unexpected pleasure. Not even close, as it turned out. Big Bro kept his promise and never got even one enhancement. He never needed to. The factory had trained him as an all-purpose engineer, which meant any time they wanted to do something, Big Bro said, they asked him to show them how to do it. It certainly paid better than their father's old job, and Big Bro didn't have to work as hard. Sometimes the factory called him in when there was a problem with something, but they always paid him extra for it. That didn't happen a lot, though. Big Bro got to spend more time with him than their father ever had. Nana called them her guys. She never minded when they went off for hours on long walks. Sometimes they went trash picking together, looking for really weird things Zalim had thrown away, and making up crazy stories about what they were and why they'd been thrown out. Other times, they'd find a good spot where they could get a glimpse of the buildings on the edge of Zalim's 5-mile-wide disk, and try to imagine what the people in them were doing, whether they were looking down and wondering what people on the ground did every day. Those had been happy times. Hugo hadn't even known how happy. Children seldom do. He hadn't imagined things would ever be any different, even after he grew up and got a job. Sometimes he thought maybe he could be an engineer like Big Bro and tell everyone how to do things. But he seldom looked that far ahead. Mostly, he was just glad his brother shared his fascination for Zalim. Big Bro was so smart, so imaginative, so much fun. The thing was, though, Big Bro was an engineer. Just dreaming and making up stories wasn't enough, he told Hugo one day. He didn't just want to imagine what Zalim was like. He wanted to find out for real. So he'd been thinking very hard about how to do that. He took Hugo up to his workshop in the attic and showed him what he had come up with. That was the beginning of the end. In truth, the end had begun earlier when Big Bro had decided to build the flying machine, before he let Hugo in on it. Hugo knew it was seriously illegal. Heavier-than-air flight was a challenge to Zalim. Just being caught with one of those machines was a capital offense. Even if the thing couldn't actually fly, a hunter-warrior could take your head without there even being a marker out on you and collect a sizable bounty. If by some crazy turn of events you did get the machine off the ground, Centurions would shoot it out of the sky. And if there were friends or family or anybody else with you, or even just standing nearby, well, too bad for them. Better luck next lifetime. No one had tried anything so foolish in years. Even birds gave Iron City a wide berth, as Zalim defenses didn't differentiate between living creatures and machines. As a result, the only place people could see uncaged birds was way out in the Badlands, way, way out, which meant plenty of Iron City residents lived and died without ever seeing an actual bird in flight. In any case, Big Bro wasn't just some Iron City fool. He was capable of building a machine with a video camera to transmit whatever it saw. Big Bro's only problem was noise. Once he fixed that, he told Hugo, he'd fly it on a night when there was no moon in the sky. The video camera was built into the thing's actual framework, which was